Well, it's noon on Tuesday. Bill Buckmaster is still somewhere in the South Pacific, basking on an island. He encourages all of his listeners to follow him on Facebook and share the pictures that he's posted about where he is and how he's enjoying one of the most decadent 45th anniversary trips I can imagine. But good luck to Bill, and that he's doing that is wonderful. This is Shelley Fishman. And, you know, last week when Bill was on vacation, we talked with James Reel for an hour about music and some classical music and the things we'd want to be stranded on an island with for the rest of our lives. We're not going to do that today. Today, we're going to talk about stuff that's probably a little bit more practical. I'm very honored to have with me two professors from the university. Dr. Eva Maria Maggi is affiliated with the School of Government and Public Policy, as is Professor Kurtzer, Professor Paulette Kurtzer. And they're good friends, and they've agreed not to argue with each other. We'll have to kind of try to make that happen a little bit more aggressively. But just to give you a little bit of background, we're going to talk about the EU. We're going to talk about the European currency. We're going to talk about the politics, and we're going to talk about the forces that are holding the EU together and those that may be pulling it apart. Just to give you some idea, Dr. Kurtzer is a professor of public policy at the U. We have some modest credentials. This goes on for pages and pages. A PhD in political science from Rutgers, of all places. MA also from Rutgers, and a BA from Tel Aviv University in Israel. And Dr. Maggi, I'm punching up today. I'm sorry. I mean, it's like I'm way outclassed here. Dr. Maggi, PhD from Helmut Schmidt University in Germany. Where in Germany?
It's Hamburg, actually.
In Hamburg? Mm-hmm. And MA in Political Science and Sociology and Law from Eberhard Karas University in Tübingen. And a BA from Political Science and Sociology and Law from Leibniz in Hanover. So we have two experts in the EU. I'm going to break this up into about four sections, as we normally do. And the first section, we'll talk about context. What's the history of the EU? How did it get together? Where did it come from? What's its objectives? And we're going to do that all in about a minute and 30 seconds. No, we've got a lot to cover today. So let's start with a history of the EU. How did it get together? Where did it come from? Was there a common market before then? And what prompted these countries, who, after all, have been at their, you know, each other's throats, you know, for the past 3,000 years, to get together and try to stop doing that? So I'm gonna start on my left here with Dr. Maggi.
Yeah, I think, first of all, thanks for having us today. I think it's very important to talk about the European Union. And I think I probably would take a book about the European Union on an island if I would be in the South Pacific right now. But I think the first thing that we need to keep in mind is that the European Union has created the longest period of peace on the European continent we have seen. So we have roughly 70 years of peace in a time with over 40 active conflicts raging around the world. So it is foremost a peace project, but has been so successful because the now 28 countries on the European continent and came together to trade. And that was after World War II. So the first treaty, and that's what we have, a couple of treaties, eight all in all since World War II, was founded to actually cooperate on coal and steel. And those goods that you need to rebuild an economy or a country after a raging war. And from then on, the countries came together more and more, and over six times enlarged. So there are more and more members coming together and to build this union. And they always had trade and economy on the center of their endeavor, and then kind of like went further from that.
Dr. Kurtzer, how big is the EU? How many countries? What's approximate population, and maybe a little bit about their GDP.
Well, their population with Britain is 500 million, and so it's by far the largest single market in the world. In terms of GDP, I'm actually not sure, but it's larger than the U.S. The EU contains quite a few member states that are very export-oriented, so the EU itself is a very large player in the world economy. Germany is either the first or second largest exporting country, and then many of the other European countries are also export-heavy. And there's 28 member states now, that is still including the UK. Without the UK, there's going to be 27. As Dr. Maggi mentioned, it started in the 1950s with only six member states. These were six neighboring countries, three large ones and three small ones. Germany, France, and Italy were the large ones. And then Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg were the three small ones. And then in 73, Britain, Ireland, and Denmark join, and then in the 80s, the Mediterranean countries of Portugal, Spain, and Greece join. And then in the mid-90s, Scandinavia and Austria joins, but not Norway, Sweden, and Finland. And then in the 2000s, we have the former kind of Soviet satellites countries that join, as well as Cyprus and Malta.
So quite briefly, if I'm a country living in Europe, because, you know, I'm a country living in Europe, and I'm looking at the possibility of joining the EU, what's in it for me? What do I gain? What do I lose? Quickly. Let's continue with you, Dr. Prezak.
First of all, in order to be eligible to be a member of the EU, you have to be indeed in Europe, which is why Turkey is controversial. A tiny part of Turkey is in Europe. Most of it is not. And second, you have to be a liberal democracy. And you have to have a market economy. Well, what you get in a return is you get access to a very large single market, 500 million residents, and a lot of the barriers against trade have been removed. And you also improve your visibility in international affairs, because if you're Slovenia, very small and tiny, if you're Slovenia, you will not count for anything in world affairs. But if you're Slovenia in the EU, you have the EU that increases your power and visibility and your ability to influence world affairs.
I see. And Dr. Maggi, when did the common currency come into effect, and how does it work that some countries have adopted it and some have not?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Some people think that the Eurozone, so the countries that actually use the common currency, is the same as the European Union. And actually, we have nine countries right now that do not use the euro. So that's important. So it came about in a process, and I talked about treaties. So it was 1999 that they really decided to put the euro in place. And then one country joined after another. So it kind of is not a big bang moment that everybody joined at once. It can kind of be a process. So whenever you join the European Union, however, you have to, legally at least, join the Eurozone at some point, although we know United Kingdom has been a member since 73 and has not adopted the euro. So you don't have to put that in practice, but legally you are obligated to.
I didn't know that. That's something that's new information for me. So if you join the EU, you've made a commitment to the common currency, though the time limits and the actual process may be a bit less well-defined.
Right. It depends. You know, you can also just have your national currency pegged, which means, you know, your exchange rate is connected to the euro. You know, there are different ways out. We had a referendum, for example, in Denmark that decided not to join the euro. So it's possible to be a full-fledged member and not have the euro as a currency.
Okay. So one of the things we talked about was open borders. And that's one of the benefits you get. I remember I was in Germany, actually, on the one-year anniversary of the wall coming down. And I had flown there from Paris because I was on vacation in Paris. And I was absolutely shocked. I got on the plane in Paris, got off the plane in Frankfurt. And there was no customs. There was nothing. You just kind of walk through. Now it's a little bit different. But how open are these borders, and is it uniform throughout the EU?
Every question about the EU requires a multi-layered and very nuanced answer, unfortunately. So in 1986, the then 12 member states decided on the creation of the single market. And the single market is a removal of all barriers against the movement of people, capital, goods and services. And the idea was that it would take 6 years to complete this project of the single market. And in the first 6 years, what they definitely were able to achieve was the removal of physical barriers to the free movement of goods and people. The issue is, after the 1990s, especially with the fall of the fall of the wall and the end of the Iron Curtain, that you suddenly had a free movement that extended beyond just the core of the EU. And so then they decide that they need to govern and regulate the free movement of people. And that is actually a different treaties. And I started my answer by saying that everything is very nuanced, because as Dr. Maggi pointed out about the Eurozone, not every country is a full member of the agreements that govern the free movement of people, which is called the Schengen Treaty, but no longer exists as a separate treaty. And the UK, for example, is not a member of the Schengen Treaty.
As I found out when I tried to come back to the UK. So just a couple of weeks ago. We're going to take a break now. I'm going to remind our audience that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico. And it's just 3 hours east of Tucson, and there's really so much to do in Silver City and Grant County. But for a complete listing of the many things to do and the great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. We'll be back with Drs. Maggi and Kurtzer and talk more about the EU and how it governs itself.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastro pub, serving an impressive menu of craft beer and fine fare. Choose from more than 175 beers from around the world, plus wine and a full bar. Enjoy delicious soups, salads, burgers, sandwiches, hearty entrees, and more. Craft beer, fine fare, great service, and stunning views. Noble Hops, perfect for lunch, dinner, happy hour, late night, and any time in between. Open daily at La Cañada and Lambert Lane in Oro Valley. This is Bill Buckmaster. One of my passions is travel, visiting over 100 countries in all 50 states. When I'm ready to take off, I fly from Tucson International Airport, with six airlines flying nonstop to 19 destinations and easy one-stop connections. I can get virtually anywhere in the world. It's close by, convenient, with competitive airfares, and the best part is there's no long drive coming back home after a long trip. Check out flytucson.com, travel smart, and fly Tucson. It's the way to go. The Regional Transportation Authority and its members are working together to deliver transportation improvements to our region. More than 770 improvements have been completed to date. The success of the RTA is built upon collaboration and leadership that focuses on addressing our regional mobility needs to make our region a safer, more efficient, and more vibrant place to live. Better roads, better transit, better choices, a better future. More at rtamobility.com.
Summer reading is free and fun at the Pima County Public Library. Visit library.pima.gov to find your next favorite book and browse hundreds of activities and special events just for kids now through July 15th. Dream big this summer. Visit your local library or library.pima.gov to find out how.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The average person in the USA today takes over 12 prescription medicines each year. And if you are over age 65, it is more than 17 medicines. CredibleMeds.org is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping inform you and your healthcare providers. Over 30,000 people die each year from reactions to their medicines. Don't be one of those numbers. Be informed and stay safe. Visit CredibleMeds.org today and take control of your healthcare by taking your medicines safely.
We're back. This is Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster, and I am very honored to have two guests from the university, Dr. Eva Maria Maggi and also Dr. Paulette Kurtzer, both professors at the U, specializing in matters European and the European Union, the Eurozone, and in their particular areas of expertise, security and economics. And so we're kind of just doing a survey course, if you will, on what this all means and why it's important. We talked a little bit in the first section about where the UK, the EU came from and how it formed. I'd like to just remind our listeners that if you'd like to participate in the discussion, if you have a question or a comment, 790-2040 is the Buckmaster Live line. Don't hesitate to give us a call if you can. What I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about the process of the EU. How is it structured? How is it governed? How do we make these countries that have such a history of strife, what are the commonalities that bring them together? How do they stop from being at each other's throats? Let's start with Dr. Maggi.
Yeah, thank you. I mentioned at the beginning that trade is the key here. I mean, the one reason we think that we have so long period of peace in Europe is because countries figured out that trade is much better than fighting each other on the battlefield. So it is an interesting setup in the European Union. And some people say, oh, it's a political system, for example, like the federal system in the United States. Others say, oh, it's an international organization like the United Nations. So it's probably something in between, but everybody has their own take on that. But it's, I think, important to take away. There are around 14 institutions, so full-fledged institutions, that make policy, that decide. So, for example, we have a European Parliament that is the second largest parliament in the world after India, 751 members. Then we have a European Commission, very similar to a government, some say, although we need to be careful with that. They mainly do policy work and proposals. But we also do have a Court of Justice, very similar to the Supreme Court here. But most importantly are institutions that bring the member states together. And I think that is key to understanding the European Union. It's really made up of, out of these 28 or soon 27 member states. So they really need to approve any major decision.
And that affects all of the countries?
Yes. So it's not that the European Commission decides over the heads of the member states. It's really the member states that come together and decide. So they have basically a constant veto over everything. So the European Commission executes what the member states decide. But that's often the case, unfortunately. Member states kind of scapegoat, you know, use the EU as a scapegoat for their own failures domestically.
Is representation in the EU Parliament by population, is it more like our Senate or more like our House? Dr. Kurtzer.
Yes. The European Parliament holds elections every 5 years, and it is by population. Each country is divided in relatively large districts, and then voters vote for a candidate that runs in that district. The European Parliament used to be, until 1979, basically a talking shop. Literally, they just discussed laws and proposals, but they had no right to vote and to co-decide. But over the decades, new treaties have been passed, and those treaties have expanded the power of the European Parliament. And today, the European Parliament is a very important actor on European legislation. Alas, unfortunately, most voters do not fully recognize that and see European parliamentary elections like midterm elections in the United States, usually to express their grievances with national governments instead of a positive vote for a good representation at the European level.
So there's no kumbaya going on there. We still have
none.
28 countries with their own particular self-interests. And
not at all. I would definitely, I have to correct that.
Okay.
Excuse me.
No, no, please.
Yes. No. The elections are by districts in countries, and let's say they run for a Christian Democratic Party. The candidate, once they arrive at the European Parliament, they form a party bloc. They call a party family with Christian Democratic parties of the other member states. And as a matter of fact, many, many studies have shown over the decades that members of parliament do not vote according to their national identity. They vote according to their political affiliation. So conservative candidates, members of parliaments, are part of the conservative European bloc. And party discipline is very high, and they vote with the bloc, sometimes against the interest of their national governments.
That must be fun to come home to and confront the prime minister of their country and say, well, here's why I did that, but don't fire me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is understood that once you go at the European level, you're not there in order to defend and protect your national interest. You're there to advance European legislation that is the best for the European consumer slash voter.
Okay. And you are elected anyway by European citizens, so
yes,
you're not actually connected to any governments directly, so the government can actually not fire you.
No. Ah, okay.
No. The voter can.
Okay. The voter can.
What language are deliberations of the parliament held in?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So we have 24 official languages.
Oh my gosh.
Which is blowing. Yeah, 24 official languages means every single legal act needs to be translated into 24 languages. And everybody that speaks one of these languages has the right to have an interpreter. So everybody can speak in their native language in the parliament, for example, but needs to have an interpreter in the back that professionally interprets it to your mother language that you have.
Simultaneously,
yes.
Ah, so the population of Brussels, what, tripled?
Yeah, it's a very big office. I don't know how many people work in that office, but it's huge. I mean, it's definitely Croatian, you know, is one language. Obviously Hungarian, super difficult, you know, but most of them speak five languages, so they can translate back and forth, but it's a huge staff.
Okay.
One of the issues with the European Parliament, if you try to be witty in your own language, but then it has to be translated into 23. No, it doesn't work. The jokes get lost.
Right.
So and just to dip a toe into politics for a second, when there's the perception in some countries in the EU of loss of sovereignty, and we hear that, and perhaps what we're hearing here in the States is a little bit, you know, those parties that are shouting the loudest. But there clearly has been a political movement in individual countries that has resisted some of this and is highly suspicious of it. Let's just talk a little bit about France, because they seem to have dodged that bullet, though that bullet isn't going away. I mean, the party led by Marine Le Pen is going to be around for a while. So how does each country kind of deal with balancing the needs of Europe in general and their own, you know, political tensions? Let's start with Dr. Maggi.
Yeah, it's we're kind of going into this topic of populism, right, in Europe, and how they I think that's a very good example, you know, that development of populist parties and movements in Europe, because often we can see, especially when it comes to obviously France, Netherlands, Denmark, Germany, Austria, same way, Italy also. It's really Europe has been used by the populist movements or parties, kind of saying, oh, we lost our national sovereignty, so we need to take it back. I think it's important actually to look also beyond that, but because we don't only see that within the populist movements, but we can also see that in like more established parties. They have really adopted a more Euroskeptical sometimes agenda. So that is definitely a constant shift, and I think today more than ever an issue in elections. For example, what we see now in Germany, really trying to balance out, for example, the new bailout, the new negotiation for Greece, and really keeping that into the in the hands of the tax payers in Germany.
Dr. Kreuzer, let's talk a little bit about Brexit. I don't want to dwell too much on it, but it follows right on to what Dr. Maggi was talking about. The loss of sovereignty, of course. Yeah. So the Brits got together and voted to leave the European Union, and without getting too much into the details of that, what do you think was the major concern that led to a decision like that? It wasn't an overwhelming decision, but it was nevertheless a majority of those voting.
Well, that is at once a very simple and a very complicated question, yeah? The simple answer would be, oh, they're worried about the loss of sovereignty, the loss of control over borders, especially with large influx of migrants. But we have to remember these migrants that we're talking about now are fellow Europeans, yes, who, with the single market and the free movement of labor, were able to take positions that a lot of Brits have no interest in because they're very low wage and low skill, and some of them are seasonal. So that would be the simple answer. I think the larger issue here is there was a referendum on the EU, but did these voters really vote on the EU? Or did they vote on whatever they thought this referendum represented?
Politics is never perfect.
Yeah, never perfect, yeah. Because a lot of the campaigning was also not really about the EU. This referendum was held without any restrictions or constraints or conditions or qualifications. In the United States, when we have an amendment to the Constitution, it's a very complex process. In Britain, this is also the equivalent of an amendment to a constitution. Sure. It was just an up and down referendum. Even the British Parliament did not vote on it.
Let's talk more about that after the break. Let's take a break now, reminding our listeners that this portion of the Buckmaster Show is presented by Green Things, located at 3384 East River Road, just west of the intersection of Dodge and River. Green Things is something you should really check out. It's on 13 acres. It's gorgeous, and it's green. So for more, visit greenthingsarizona.com, and we'll take a break.
Tucson now has its own Creole restaurant, named after the classic New Orleans cocktail. Sazerac Creole Kitchen and Cocktail Parlor is located in St. Philip's Plaza at River and Campbell. The New Orleans-inspired menu includes a full range of gumbos and much-loved beignets. See you soon at Sazerac, open daily, 8 a.m. to midnight at St. Philip's Plaza.
Hi, Suzanne Miller from your Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona, here to remind you to start with trust and look for the BBB accredited seal when searching for a product or service. Did you know you can request a quote directly from any of our accredited businesses? With over 3,000 accredited businesses in Southern Arizona, you will find a business you can trust. Whether you need a product or service from one company or an entire industry, go to tucson.bbb.org and start your search today.
If you're searching for that special one-of-a-kind item, may I suggest Adobe House Antiques? It has a vast collection and variety of antiques, lighting, and fine art. In addition to the interior space, a large outdoor location offers an extensive collection of vintage patio furniture, exterior lighting, and ironwork. Come see Penny at 2700 North Campbell, 325-9439, or on the web at adobehouseantiques.com.
Southern Arizona News Examiner, reporting from a different perspective. Dive into the culture section with the latest on the arts. Book reviews from Rebecca Guthrie. What movies are hot or not from Bob Garber. Eric Peters brings his unique point of view with his auto reviews. Check out where you could vacation regardless of the season. It is culture news from a different perspective. The Southern Arizona News Examiner. Free subscriptions at soaznewsx.com.
It's a land and cruise vacation sale at Bon Voyage Travel. Plan your dream vacation now and save big, up to 65%. Alaska, Hawaii, Europe, South America, the Caribbean, pick your perfect destination. Bon Voyage Travel will create your exclusive getaway that includes extra perks and bonuses you won't find anywhere else. Call Bon Voyage Travel today or visit bvtravel.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster. Green Things has been the place for all things green for the Buckmaster household for many years. From 2-inch succulents to 10-foot tall palms and desert trees, Green Things has it all on 13 acres and 33 greenhouses full of plants, pottery, and gardening supplies. Visit Green Things at 3384 East River Road by the Rito Riverwalk and on the web at greenthingsaz.com. Vero Amore is Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino and on Dove Mountain Boulevard in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamore.com.
And we're back. This is Shelley Fishman sitting in for the vacationing, the very vacationing, Bill Buckmaster, as he's off in the South Pacific. And we are very pleased to have two guests from the University of Arizona with us talking about the EU and the Eurozone and other things European, Dr. Eva Maria Maggi and Dr. Paulette Kurtzer. Both teach at the School of Political Science and Government and Public Policy here at the university. We were talking a little bit about politics and how politics in Europe is now affecting perhaps the very future of the EU and how it views itself. We just began to get into the idea of Brexit and what leaving the EU might mean for the EU and for the UK, assuming the UK stays united, which is another issue entirely. So if you have a question or want to join the discussion, please, I encourage you, 790-2040. And let's pick up with Brexit for a second. I just got back from the UK and spent some time speaking with businessmen and also generally people who I kind of encountered about how they felt about Brexit and what their hopes and fears were. Most of the people I encountered couldn't believe that the UK would actually leave the EU. But most of the people I encountered were in London, which voted to stay, and Edinburgh, which voted to stay. So Dr. Maggi, a little bit about what you think, how this is going to roll out, or if it will roll out. I have this sneaking suspicion in the back of my mind that Prime Minister May might find a way to make this happen over a very, very long period of time, like decades.
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question right now, I guess. But I think for now we can, believe what she has stated, and that will be a quick and painless, hopefully, for them, exit from the European Union. So I don't think we can see on the horizon that this is not going to happen. I think that will, and she totally adopted the rhetoric from the United Kingdom Independence Party and the referendum outcome. So I don't think we can see any way of turning away from this
decision. So you think this two-year process, or is it 3 years,
supposed to be 2 years.
Yeah,
supposed
two-year process,
to be 2 years, yeah.
Will kind of happen in a relatively orderly fashion. I know that when I was there was some discussion of the commitment, the ongoing commitment that the UK has in terms of obligations to the EU.
Yes, if I can just elaborate on your first question. Maybe Prime Minister May wants to stretch it out for decades. Of course, that means that she's no longer Prime Minister. But the European Commission and the European Council have made it very clear that they're not willing to stretch this out because it creates a lot of uncertainty. And uncertainty is not good. It's not good for politics, not good for business, not good for the economy. So we don't know what exactly the game plan is of Prime Minister May, but we do know what the game plan is of the European Union, and that is to not allow them to stretch it out forever and ever.
I mean, we hear about, for instance, a hundred billion euro obligation on the part of the UK just to get out of the EU. And when I was there, there was a lot of discussion about that because the Brits couldn't understand how they could possibly owe 100 billion euros to the EU. Well, it turns out there are projects, commitments, contracts, things underway that, you know, the UK has been part of.
And pension liabilities. Don't forget that many Brits have been part of the European Commission and either are drawing a pension now or will draw a pension in the future. So Britain has to continue to contribute to the budget. Of course, we have to remember 100 billion, that's a nice round number, that is open for negotiation.
Of course.
Remember, everything is open for a negotiation. But a sense of signal that the EU does not want this to be painless, because that is a very useful lesson for any other member states that it might contemplate they can just leave the EU. So the European Union has a twofold game plan, not to drag this out forever and ever, and second, to make it painful.
So let me add to that, because I think it's interesting to look at other cases, other countries that are not in the European Union but have a strong, close relationship to it and are on the European continent. So we have Norway and Switzerland. And just let me talk about Norway for a second, because I think it's interesting. So Norway is not part of the European Union, but they say after his, that around two-thirds of his legislation is somehow affected by EU legislation. So they adopt EU law constantly and are part of the single market.
And
standards and all that. So it's roughly estimated 0.16% of its GDP, roughly averaged from 2008 to 2014, Norway contributed to the EU budget. So the UK paid for the same time, although being full member, 0.25% of the GDP. So that is, if you think about it, not that much higher than Norway. So if you think that UK will leave, there needs to be and still wants to be part of the single market. There will be still contributions to the EU budget. And I think that's often not understood. It's not that you leave and you're out out of any financial contributions. I mean, of course, it's the pensions, but also just simply for paying to being part of that single market. They will have to be contributing to the budget without having a say in the decision-making process. And that's a big deal.
That's kind of taxation without representation.
Right. Well, it's not a tax. That's important to say, though. It's not a tax. The EU does not have any taxation powers. It's important to mention. People think that's the case, but actually not. But it is a contribution to have the benefits of having access to the largest free trade market in the world, plus other aspects that come to it, but that's the major.
And what are the – let's take the other example, Switzerland. Now, Switzerland has a long history of being independent and being neutral and kind of making its own way through the center, the very center of Europe, Western Europe. What have they given up and what could they gain if they took another look at it?
Well, Switzerland is in a very similar situation as Norway in that it has a lot of associate treaty status, which basically means a lot of its legislation mirrors and corresponds what the EU is doing. Switzerland is also part of the Schengen, original Schengen, so there's a free movement of people. So I guess the Swiss would say, certainly in the old days, they have the best of both worlds. Now they have access to the EU, but they're not part, for example, financial integration. And as we know, Swiss banks are very shady institutions. But even that particular advantage has been lost to them because the EU has clamped down on Swiss banks as they tended to shelter and harbor a lot of tax evaders, European tax evaders. But the Swiss have had a very conscious strategy of being half in, half out in order to protect the financial sector from EU regulations, although that protection has been, you know, weakened over time.
Sure, sure. So, you know, I did a little bit of math. If I take the GDP of all of the EU and kind of divide it into the population, we get about a 30,000 euros, or actually $30,000 per capita economy in the EU population. Now, it's not equally distributed, clearly. You have some, and we're going to talk about that at the end, some countries that are doing much better financially than others. If I do the same math with the U.S., the number comes out to about $56,000. Now, that would indicate on the surface that the U.S. is a lot richer in terms of its GDP per capita than the EU. I've been to a lot of Europe. Doesn't seem that way. I'm going to throw that up to either one of you and let you comment on it.
Well, yeah, these GDP per capita figures are a little bit misleading as they're also determined and influenced by the exchange rate.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, so we really have to look at
purchase
parity.
I reduced it to dollars. So it's apples to apples in the sense that it's always dollars.
Yes, but the exchange rate between the euro and the dollar fluctuates. Yeah, so that GDP per capita in dollars in Europe can change with changes in the exchange rate. So what economists usually use is purchase power parity, which is a better way of comparing what the purchase power is of individuals.
And how does that compare?
Oh, I think, I don't know. These things are, I don't think, that critical. Probably the U.S. is higher, but as maybe you know, inequality is very high in the United States.
And
so that you have a couple of billionaires.
Good inequality, yes.
Inequality.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, very good point.
An excellent point. Of course.
GDP per capita is a very rough estimate of, quote unquote, the wealth of a region. What really matters is the purchase power parity.
Interesting.
And what really matters is redistribution. Because to have a very high GDP, but 20% is controlled by three different people, tells us, you know, that
right. So
the income of many of the others is very low.
How that economic wealth is distributed among the people, and there we get into whole discussions about the social contract and how Europeans in general view the role of government vis-a-vis the role of the people who are protected by government or not. Well, let's take a quick break and come back and talk about that politics and talk a little bit more about economics. And we'll talk a little bit also about some of the things going on right now in terms of open borders and terrorism.
American Openings is pleased to sponsor Hands of Hope. Hands of Hope believes every life matters, and they're committed to walking alongside women to provide confidential, non-judgmental care so they can make the best decisions when unsure about continuing with the pregnancy. You can learn more about Hands of Hope at GiveHopeTucson.com. American Openings is a locally owned door and window manufacturer and is blessed to be a sponsor of a local ministry doing so much to protect life.
This is Bill Buckmaster. I love travel and flying from Tucson International Airport. And when you fly Tucson, you're standing up for Tucson. When more people fly Tucson, airlines respond with more flights. And with more flights, more travelers can get here to conduct important business. It's a win for the region, and it's a win for you in time saved and money saved not traveling to an airport 2 hours away. Next time you book a flight, type in TUS. Travel smart and fly Tucson. It's the way to go. The Regional Transportation Authority works with its member jurisdictions, the business community, project neighbors, and the broader community to deliver transportation projects promised in 2006. This collaborative effort is a model of diverse interests coming together for the benefit of the region. This spirit of regional collaboration helps us address the mobility and safety needs in all of our communities. Better roads, better transit, better choices, a better future. More at rtamobility.com.
Summer reading is free and fun at the Pima County Public Library. Visit library.pima.gov to find your next favorite book and browse hundreds of activities and special events just for kids now through July 15th. Dream big this summer. Visit your local library or library.pima.gov to find out how.
As a small business owner, I know the importance of a certified public accountant you can trust. That's why I recommend my CPA, Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates, proud sponsors of the Buckmaster Show. Located at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com or follow the live link on buckmastershow.com.
Hi, this is Sean McCluskey, co-owner and designated broker for Rincon Ventures. If you're a rental owner by choice or by accident and you're looking to hire or change property management companies, consider Rincon Ventures. We employ an aggressive web-based advertising strategy to market your rental. We thoroughly screen prospective tenants and conduct routine property inspections. Our online system gives tenants the ability to pay rent and file maintenance requests instantly over the web. Our owners can use the same system to instantly check on their properties. Call Rincon Ventures at 881-2258 or visit us on the web at rvprop.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
The excitement is building for the grand opening in 2017 for the Twisted Tandoor. The legendary Indian food truck will now have a permanent brick-and-mortar home at Swan and Camp Lowell Drive. The menu will be an expansion of the Indian classic offerings from the original Twisted Tandoor food truck. The Twisted Tandoor, coming in 2017 at 4660 East Camp Lowell Drive.
And this is back in the studio live, Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster with Drs. Maggi and Kurtzer from the U of A talking about the EU. And so I want to talk a little bit about economic development, and I want to talk about some of the positive stuff. We hear about the inequalities. We hear about the problems in Greece and in Portugal and in Iceland and in some of the problems that we've heard about over the years. But the EU is the United States' largest trading partner. So we have a stake in the economic development and outcomes that the EU is striving to achieve. So Dr. Maggi, let's start with you again. Talk a little bit about economic development and how the EU is setting goals for themselves and attempting to integrate not only with the United States economy, but also the emerging Asian economies.
Yeah, so I think it's important to keep in mind that the U.S. and the EU are the largest integrated free market or market in the world. So I think we always forget that, you know, talk about China and India. You know, we need to keep that in mind. So it's, of course, important what's going on in the EU. And I think when it comes to the Eurozone, again, you know, those countries in Europe that used the euro as a currency, we have seen, you know, Greece tumbling the last couple of years. We have seen the big financial crisis, and it has not really recovered to the extent, you know, the European Union as a whole, but also specific countries as they hope for. However, in 2017, the EU is on track, actually, for the fifth year of consecutive growth, which I think is important to mention, but it's 1.6%, so it's really not much. But from the 24 countries that were under some form of financial assistance in 2011, we're actually down to four in 2017. So I think there's definitely been a big development. And just recently, yesterday, the European Commission announced that Portugal is actually out of the financial assistance scheme, at least from their perspective. So member states still have to agree to that assessment. But so that are good news. Of course, we have Ireland. But we still have the big problem child here, Italy and Greece, foremost here. Italy will grow less in 2017 than any other EU country, has new elections next year, big political turmoil. The Prime Minister Renzi resigned last year after losing in constitutional referendum, you know, strong populist movements here too. So it will be interesting elections next year. Greece, the same, a little bit in the sense that we still don't have an agreement between mainly Germany and the International Monetary Fund on how to relieve the debt of Greece. It's still going on, and with Germany's election in the fall, we probably won't have a decision on that this summer. That means, though, there needs to be a new bailout this summer, and it will be interesting to see how the IMF and Germany come to an agreement there without the German government being must be afraid of losing the elections in September. So I think that are important development. Overall, it's getting better.
It's getting better, right. So we're hearing that the European Central Bank is thinking very aggressively about cutting back on stimulus. And so talking about not individual countries, but in terms of economic development overall, Dr. Kurzer, how does the central bank affect the overall economic health of the EU?
Well, I am not sure that a central bank's mission is to preside over economic development. The European Central Bank responded to a liquidity crisis that is in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. A lot of banks in Europe refused to lend money. And when banks don't lend money, that means the end of economic activity. So the ECB, also in the Federal Reserve Bank, did exactly the same.
Yeah,
stepped in as the lender of last resort and pumped in liquidity in the economy. But I am not sure that is directly related to economic development in and by itself. And it should not be. Economic development is really a very complex structural process. And the European Union, when it has these waves of enlargement, starting with six very homogeneous member states, and then including Central Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean countries, has become much more diverse. And if we think of countries as regions, like you have in the United States regions, some regions are more developed than other regions. Some regions are more integrated in the international economy than other regions. And it is a problem. Of course, it is a problem because they're part of the single market.
Right.
Yeah? So it is a problem. Yeah. And the problem is amplified in the European Union because in the United States, you have a real federal system. And the federal government, through both direct and indirect means, redistribute funds and money to all regions.
And that doesn't happen in the EU?
But in Europe, you don't have that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you don't have a federal government that is capable of redistribution. So you get poor areas, poor countries,
stay poor.
Rich, and in some ways, well, the idea is that open markets and the free movement of labor and services will lift them up. And it does lift them up to a point, but not totally. Yeah?
Right,
not
and totally. We saw that in Spain. I mean, during the build-up to 2008, we had so much German investment in Spain, especially in Spanish, in the housing market in Spain. And when that market collapsed, the effects on the Spanish economy were immense. So when you have those kinds of inequalities, you know, it's like sleeping with an elephant. If the elephant rolls over, you can get crushed.
Let me just respond to this. I think here the analogy is really Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs buying mortgage-backed securities. Yeah.
Okay.
So that is the analogy. I'm not sure that the fact that German banks lend to Spain or that Spain issue a lot of mortgage-backed securities, that is the issue in and by itself. There was a lot of speculative investments both in Europe and in the United States, and everybody got crushed. Also, German banks, by the way. Some of them had to be bailed out by the federal government. Yeah.
So I want to make sure that we have time for one thing, and this is kind of a promotion. Dr. Kurza, you are the director of an online Master of Arts program in the fields of security, intelligence, foreign policy, and foreign affairs. And you've had 150 active students, and you just graduated 60 students. So tell us a little bit about the program in 30 seconds.
In 2010, the School of Government and Public Policy created an online master program in international security studies. Our program has been a big success. All the courses are delivered online, and so our students are anywhere in the world, Korea, Germany, anywhere in the United States. And it emphasizes international security, and it draws students who are currently working in the intelligence, security, defense establishment, as well those who are in the private sector and maybe are seeking a switch of career. We have many active military, and we have veterans, as well as others. Both me and Dr. Maggi teach in this particular program. We offer 30-plus courses.
So if members of the audience, especially military members, because we have a large military audience here, if they want to contact you and get more information about how they can perhaps participate in this MA program, how do they do that?
They can call 520-621-7600 and ask for the International Security Studies program, or they can go online. And the online address is...
International Security Studies Program, University of Arizona.
Say usually it again, get Dr.
International Securities Program at the Security Studies Program at the University of Arizona, and you get it pretty quickly.
We are unfortunately out of time. I hope that some people do contact you. This is great stuff. I want to thank both Drs. Maggi and Kurzer for their generous gift of time today. And I think we all got a little bit smarter. I hope we had some fun at the same time. This is Shelley Fishman sitting in for Bill Buckmaster. And next Tuesday, we're back to the regular schedule.